Okay, good morning to everyone. Today we have Professor Keating here. He's a professor of law and philosophy at the Faculty of Law at the University of Southern California. We're very glad to have him for the second time in Girona. This time we almost missed him. He lost his train. He missed his train to Girona from Barcelona, and he had to take a taxi, and he just arrived a few minutes ago. Thank you. Greg,
for only being Americans here. Can get befuddled by trains, I guess, probably. Oh.
Thank you, Greg, for being here. He's going to present a paper criticizing another of our speakers. We have Arthur Richtlein 2 weeks from now.
Oh.
He will present some of his ideas. He's presenting a paper that is called Form and Substance in the Private Law of Torts, and he's mainly a criticism, an extensive criticism of Ripstein private wrongs. Well, you know, the usual format is like 30 to 40 minutes for the presentation and then the rest of the time for the debate.
Okay.
I want to especially thank you for being here. And you're always welcome to come back. It's your time now.
It's always, the last visit was lots of fun. It's Spain, you live in a beautiful country. And I learned a lot the last time, so it's very nice to be here. So I should be coming after Arthur, but so it goes. So this is a critique of, it is primarily Arthur Ripstein's view of tort law. Before Arthur Ripstein, Ernie Weinrib, also Canadian, they're on the same faculty at Toronto, has a very similar view. And the way I think of the view is, in the United States, tort law became dominated starting in the 1960s by economic analyses. And they are uncompromisingly instrumentalist. You may have read Calabresi and people like that. Essentially, they think the role of the liability system is to minimize the combined costs of accidents and their prevention, and that involves a certain kind of deterrence and a certain kind of loss spreading. And you arrange liability rules so they're entirely forward-looking and oriented towards an idea of social welfare. And the most uncompromising kind of response to this, that is, don't give any ground, just take a polar opposite position, really comes from Weinrib and Ripstein. And it's uncompromising because they embrace the label formalist, which in the US legal academy is the kiss of death. People don't want to be called formalists. And they welcome the label formalist, and they say that formalism, in fact, is the key to understanding the law of torts, and what the instrumentalists come up with can't explain the law of torts. And in Weinrib's version of this, the key is the bipolar form of a tort lawsuit. And Ripstein incorporates this, or folds it in, but he goes beyond it. But let me explain why the bipolar form is a powerful way to criticize an economic analysis of law. It's powerful because in a bipolar form is the plaintiff sues the defendant saying, you wronged me, as a result of your wrong, you could say my rights were violated, you could say I was harmed, you could say I was injured, different implications, but the basic idea is, as a result of your wrong, I'm going to say harmed, I've been harmed, and you must therefore repair the harm that you've wrongly done to me by paying me compensation, or occasionally by some other remedy. And this is a kind of truism sort of description of a tort lawsuit. You might explain it, blame a lawsuit to a first-year student or to a non-lawyer, you might say something like that. And the essential Weinrib point, and other corrective justice theorists have made this point too in somewhat different ways, is, well, you can't even say that from an economic point of view. Because from an economic point of view, all you can say about a lawsuit is, we ought to impose liability on the party in the best position to minimize the cost of this kind of accident going forward. So there was famous early writing debating causation in tort law. Calabresi, one of his most important pieces, was a debate with a tort scholar at University of Chicago called Harry Calvin on cause and the law of torts, because you can't assign any importance to backward-looking notions of causation. You caused me harm in an economic framework. You have to say there are statistical correlations such that it's a good idea to impose the cost on the wrongdoer, because that will deter future parties from committing inefficient harms going forward. And the point of Weinreb is, and other corrective justice theories, is this is very implausible. It doesn't capture, it's an extremely convoluted account of the form of private lawsuit, and it just doesn't capture our intuitive sense of what it's about. And in fact, what we think is you sue somebody because they wronged you, and they have to compensate you if you can prove they wronged you, because they wrongly harmed you and they're responsible for the harm that they did to you, and that's the tort lawsuit. And so the economic theory is just a theory of something else. Now, what's formalist about this is that Weinreb then says the entire morality of tort law can just be tumble out kind of the form. Once you see that it's a bipolar regime of responsibility, you can just extract the substance. And I'm going to then here turn to Ripstein, because Ripstein's my fundamental concern, though I keep touching on Weinreb. And they depart on this. What Ripstein says, and this is influenced, I don't know if you've been reading him, but he wrote a very important book on Kant's legal philosophy called Force and Freedom. And that book did a lot in the English-speaking world to revive the idea that Kant's legal philosophy was an independently important piece of his writing. I think Hannah Arendt treated his legal philosophy, I think she said about it somewhere, this seems to have been written when Kant was entering his senescence. And it has never been treated by American Kant scholars as a really important text equivalent to the great writings in moral theory or even the very important essays on political philosophy like Perpetual Peace. And what Ripstein said is, no, this is very important, and it tries to establish that there's one basic principle of legal morality, and that principle is that each of us isn't in charge of ourselves, and none of us in charge of anyone else. So it's a certain idea of independence, that we are all civically independent, all right? And what Ripstein does in Private Wrongs is to say we can make, uses the word perspicuous, which he means it makes intelligible the entire law of torts if you take this principle, okay? And so this is very influential, although outside philosophy circles, it's not super influential in American law schools, and partly because in American law schools, under the influence of legal realism, we don't take categories, conceptual categories, very seriously. So if a law professor at Yale, or say, says, no, this is private law, they might as well have just picked up a file folder and said, we throw it into this slot. They aren't saying anything more than that, okay? And usually what people think in the United States of claiming something's private law, they get immediately worried because they imagine a realm that's walled off from judgments, general judgments of political morality. It's just exempt, so it's kind of like a state of nature. And these things have very bad histories in family law, essentially the absolute power of husbands over their wives in the 19th century. There's a private realm that's insulated from any kind of civic accountability. And libertarians kind of pick up on this and imagine a world of private authority. And that's not what Ripstein is driving at all. And the fundamental difference is that for the libertarian, authority comes from consensual agreements between persons. Contract is the ideal source of authority. You really don't have a state. You know, Nozick works very hard to generate even a night watchman state. And if you think of it in private law terms, you have property, which is stuff you have acquired one way or another. You have contract, which is how you alter your relations with other persons. And you have tort only when you can't have property or contract because it's inferior because it doesn't involve consent. You have to figure out what the parties would have consented to. And you disfavor tort as much as possible. Ripstein's view is different because his view is that that tort law requires civic authority. Only the state can create the law of torts. This is part of his political philosophy and Kant's famous thesis that you have to, you can coerce people out of the state of nature because you can't have a realm of equal right in the state of nature. You can only have a realm of equal right inside civic society because only something with the authority of the state can articulate the terms of equal right. And so that's the background, and what Ripstein then says is the content of equal right in torts is just given by the idea of no one being in charge of anyone else and everyone being in charge of themselves. So this has, I'm going to claim it has diverse problems, all right? And they're both philosophical and legal, okay? And in its, in, let me call the legal problems interpretive problems. I think there are problems in gross, meaning large problems writ large, and then problems in fine. And the problems in gross are calling tort private law is, I think, problematic in the context of the American legal system. Part of tort is private law, but I think the law of torts that we have in the United States takes shape in the late 19th century. It's when you kick to the curb the forms of action in England and you get a unified system of civil procedure. And at the same time, you have the problem of accidental harm emerging as the fundamental social problem. Oliver Wendell Holmes, in his essay, The Path of the Law, has a remark, kind of aphorism, where he says, our law of torts comes from the world of isolated, ungeneralized wrongs, libels, slanders, and the like. And our modern world is preoccupied with the incidents of businesses, such as accidents, and meaning railroad accidents, accidents in the workplace, and things that are systematic byproducts of social activities. And the consequence of this is that I think when the law of torts emerges in the United States, almost immediately, you see workers' compensation emerge as both a displacement of the law of torts and intertwined with it. It displaces the private law of torts, but it's not like radically separated from it in the sense that the same principles. It repudiates fault liability, goes with strict liability. I think that if you look at the law of torts in the next 40, 50 years, you'll see that workers' compensation influences the way the common law, private law of torts is articulated. Assumption of the risk takes an entirely different form. Doctrines like vicarious liability incorporate ideas from workers' compensation. So they're intertwined. And they're intertwined because they are competing ways, sometimes cooperative ways, of responding to the same social problem. And it's actually, I think, a fundamental fact about tort law that a tort theorist needs to confront, that the only field that I know among the kinds of fields you teach as basic fields in the first year of law school, so think of contract, think of property, but also think of criminal law, only tort really is threatened with near total displacement. We know that New Zealand exists, and in New Zealand, you've eliminated all of the accident branch of tort law, which is the heart of modern tort law, and you've left individual intentional torts, which are not trivial, but they're not the core of it. You've left the periphery of the modern subject and displaced the core of it with a scheme that is direct regulation of risk to reduce risks and social insurance to compensate for harm. And it just isn't the case that anybody has ever said, we're not going to have a law of crime, we're only going to have a regime of therapy, okay? Or that we've decided we're not going to have any law of property, we're only going to have a law of use rights and it's all going to be statutory. Or that, you know, we're going to have a law of contracts that has nothing to do with voluntary agreements, it's all about as it might now be, the terms Amazon imposes on you. That might happen, but we've never said we're going to articulate about it law this way. So when Ripstein draws this radical distinction between the two domains, I think it's a fundamental mistake in trying to make perspicuous what our law is about. But in fine, I think the problem is that if we accept there's a part of tort that everyone would call private law, although an American law professor would just call it that, like throwing it into the file folder, I think Ripstein can't account for that because he absolutely prescinds from invoking interests, okay? In other words, for reasons that, although I've read a lot of this stuff, I feel I don't understand in a way that I can present it to make it sympathetic, although I think you have to be this kind of Kantian to be in the grip of this. Everyone who isn't is mystified by it. Ripstein sees any appeal to interest as an undermining of people's freedom. It seems like it's some sort of, although the category of heteronomy and autonomy is Kant's moral theory, not his legal theory, but it seems as if he thinks if you introduce interests, you inevitably become a consequentialist, or you become someone who undermines people's freedom in the name of some kind of material thing. I think that's a mistake. I think the alternative is a view that's like Rawls's or Scanlon's, which account for it but aren't consequentialist. But in any case, I think that the law of torts in the United States, and I don't think it's peculiar in this way, you can't make sense of it without giving an account of people's interests. So to give an example of what Ripstein thinks as a tort, that he divides torts into two domains. One domain has to do with, I think he calls, does he call it domination? It's not domination. One is damages, and the other is, he used to call it sovereignty, but he's got another name for it. It's wrongly taking charge of another, and you can see how that fits with the idea of independence, okay? That a tortious wrong consists of just taking charge of someone else without their permission or without any kind of authorization, and that subjects you to liability for whatever you do to them as a result of wrongly taking charge of them. The best example of such a tort is the ordinary land tort of trespass, okay? Because the ordinary land tort of trespass, at least in many incarnations, really does fit this. So that if you enter somebody else's property without their permission, that's a trespass. And what a trespass consists of is, the law of property says, if you own a piece of land, or you're the position of the owner, you're the leaseholder, whatever, but we'll call it the owner, you are able to control who enters your land and who doesn't. And the person who enters, it's subject to your will, is one way to think of it. And the person who enters asserts that they have control over your property, again, without your authorization. They, in effect, assert that they are entitled to enter your property without your consent, without your will authorizing it. So what you do is impermissibly take charge of a means that belongs to them. And when we look at most trespasses, we don't really need to look much further than, do you have permission for this entry? That's the only question we need to ask. And that's a quintessentially Ripsteinian question. And then Ripstein says the other kind of tort involves damaging your means. So he's thinking of all the harm-based torts. Negligence is preeminent among them. And he wants to assimilate those to a form of domination, okay, that I impermissibly use when I damage your means. I impermissibly interfere with the things that you have to exercise your freedom. And the idea is to try to fit those into his first category, because that's his fundamental category. So I think if you look at American law, you see problems even with the torts that appear to fit Ripstein's description. So let me give you an example that comes from battery, and then give you one from negligence, and then give you one that goes back to trespass. So in a battery, many batteries look like the kind of torts Ripstein has in mind. For example, you can commit a battery just by touching somebody without their permission, okay? I could not, as a professor in the United States, I don't know what Spanish norms are, but I bet they're not that different. I cannot go around patting my students on the head, okay? That would be a battery, unless I could come up with some excuse about how it was a pedagogical technique that gave me a privilege, all right? I almost gonna make an interest point too. If I told a female student once asked me this in connection with a battery case as an analogy, in which we had a touching that had racial implications that were very offensive. So if you patted me on the head, Professor Keating, would that be a battery? And I had, yes, definitely, I would never do that. But it's patronizing. So you wanna think there about, because you can imagine a male professor patting a female student, not that they should, but you think they do that before they pat a male student on the head, okay? Because like a male student professor patting a female student on the head and saying, what a great question, and for a girl, you know? That, and so there's something profoundly patronizing about that, all right? Now, what Ripsey's gonna say is, well, you can't touch someone without their permission. That's a violation of their independence, all right? Surely your own body is your means. So that's right, but I think that when we look at battery, we'll discover that in fact an interest drives it, okay? And in that example that I gave you, the law of battery in the United States says you can't touch someone in a way that's harmful or offensive without their permission. That's offensive, and it's offensive because it treats somebody like they're a small child. Like it would be okay for me to pat a six-year-old kid on the head and telling them to do something. You know, I wouldn't do it with a stranger, but they were a child of a friend or something. I'd do it. I do it with my own kids. They wouldn't be offended because it's a way to treat a child. But it's an offensive way to treat someone who's an adult, and it's offensive if you do it on one gender line and not along another, all right? So it offends an interest, and it offends an interest in a kind of adult status and a kind of equal status, okay? And let me give you an example. I don't know about the subways in Barcelona, but in New York City, you can be squished into the subway in such a way that you can't avoid making contact with other people. And sometimes in New York, you can't reach a strap and you can't reach a bar. You're just standing there. So you might have to support yourself as the train moves by balancing yourself against the bodies of the people next to you. You don't have permission to do that. But that's not a battery in American tort law. And the reason it's not a battery is that's not an offensive contact, okay? It's an unauthorized contact. You don't ask permission, they don't give you permission, you just do it, but it's not an offensive contact. However, if what you do is, and most women I know have had this happen to them in the New York City subway, you rub up against somebody in a sexual way, that's a battery, and it's a battery because it's profoundly offensive. All right? And if you want to explain why the two cases are different, I think you have to appeal to an interest. And what I mean by that is you have to say, well, intimate sexual contact is profoundly different from just contact. Or another example, if I tap Diego to get his attention for something because he's looking at his computer and I need a pen, that's not offensive either. But it's the role that sexuality plays in a normal person's life that means it's very important that you have control over who contacts you in an intimate way and who doesn't, okay? But without invoking an interest like that, I think you can't account for the way the tort of battery works because it isn't just lack of authorization. There are contacts we don't require authorization for, and that's because we don't think they offend an important interest that you have, all right? And in negligence, the fundamental distinction that I think Ripstein can't capture in negligence is it's wrong to assimilate negligence to the idea of domination. If you think about Ripstein's asserting control over somebody without their permission, that's a form of domination, okay? And he wants to wedge damage-based torts into that category, and you do it by saying, well, if you're damaging your means, you're damaging what it is that enables a person to function as an independent person. And in a certain loose way, that's right, but I think, again, it only works in any spot-on way if you introduce an interest and if you distinguish between domination and disregard. the sort of moral nerve of the wrong of negligence is disregard. If, for example, I'm driving around town, I don't know what people do in Barcelona late at night, but in an American city, and I'm just in a hurry, I think nobody's going to be around, so I just whip around a corner without paying any attention. You know, I think it's way 2 in the morning, who cares about the stop signs, who cares about the stoplights, and I hit somebody. I didn't come up with a really esoteric and inefficient way of dominating someone. This was not an bizarre, indirect way of asserting my will against their independence. I showed disregard for their safety. Okay, and they have an important interest in their safety because their safety is an essential condition of a kind of decent, normally functioning human life. If you're physically impaired, your ability to lead a normal life is compromised. And so I think that example shows two things. One, we have an interest at stake, and it's an interest in the physical integrity of your person that negligence protects. And why is it an interest? Because to explain it, we say, what's the role that the physical integrity of your person plays in your life? And I think the answer is, well, it's an essential condition for you functioning as an independent agent or leading a normal life. And that's why we need to safeguard it. The next thing about it is, I haven't stressed this in Ripstein, but he makes a lot of it. For Ripstein, rights are relational in a way that I think is correct and then in a way that's problematic. Relational is that I think is correct is a right is a constraint against someone else. For example, I gather you had a terrible storm in Barcelona just a few days ago. You do not have a right against nature that it not mess up your day by foul weather, all right? Because Mother Nature is not an agent that you can constrain. Rights constrain other agents. So that sounds entirely correct to me. And I think it's a general notion of a right that it's constraint on the discretion of other people imposes a duty. However, Ripstein says it's impossible to state any part of a right except as a relation among persons. I think that's a mistake. The right to the physical integrity of your person constrains other people in the law of negligence. They have to exercise due care for your protection. But the interest there, the physical integrity of your person, is independent of the right. I can have my physical integrity impaired by an earthquake, by a fire, by all kinds of natural forces. And it's my interest is just as much implicated in that. It's just that there's no sense in creating a right against it because we're not dealing with agency. So I think the interest that negligence law protects us against is antecedent to the right we have in negligence, and that the justification for the right in negligence is to say, right's kind of a measuring stick for a really important interest. This interest is important enough that we should put other people under obligations, all right? Some interests just aren't important enough, or we don't know feasibly how to put people under such constraints and manage to get on with social life. So versions of that in the law of torts go to how much emotional distress can you protect people against. People have an interest in not being emotionally distressed. It's an unpleasant state to be in. But on the whole, the law of torts provides much less protection against emotional distress than it does against physical harm. And that's because there's a view that all kinds of legitimate activities can emotionally distress somebody, and you can't create a right against it. So just imagine a divorce in which one spouse says to the other, I want a divorce, I don't love you anymore. Unless that's mutual, that's extremely distressing. But you know, you can't create a right against it because the constraint on somebody else's freedom would be unacceptable, all right? So I think that you need an interest account to have a right. Finally, let's go back to the property example. So there are, I don't know if you ever had, and we don't have them much anymore, there's like one left in LA County. It was called a drive-in movie theater. If you've ever seen a 50s American film, I'm forgetting the names of them. They're in 50s American films because they were where teenagers would go and sleep and cuddle up in the back of station wagons. You have a name for that, but I forget what it's Paul, your name for that is, and make out. Going, we're going out to the movies, you tell your parents, and then you go and make out in the back of the car, and it's in some 50s movie. Anyway, so it's an outdoor movie theater, and of course you have to project light to have an outdoor movie theater at night, called a drive-in. And there are torts cases about this, because unsurprisingly, neighbors complain about the bright lights coming onto their property. A bright light can really interfere with your ability to sleep. It could interfere with all kinds of other things if you were raising certain kinds of animals, for example. And they bring both trespass claims and nuisance claims. And the courts, it's not easy to win these cases, but the courts always knock out the trespass claim right out of the box, all right? And what they say is, hey, shining a light does not constitute a trespass. And they don't mean, well, you can't enter somebody's property with a beam of light. It surely could enter your property if I took my laser gun and shot it onto your property in a science fiction thing and, you know, set your house on fire. That would be a straightforward trespass, because you can use a beam of light and a laser to enter somebody's property. It's not about entry. It's that shining a light, courts believe, doesn't interfere with your interest in dominion, your interest in control over your property. What it interferes with, if it interferes with anything, is the interest that nuisance law protects, which is your interest in the reasonable use and enjoyment of your property. Because if you're using your property in a certain way, it might be interfered with. If you're an office building next to a drive-in movie theater, it's not going to interfere with you because you're probably not doing anything in the evening. Everybody probably goes home at 6 or 7 and you shut it down. If you're a resident, it could be interfering with your enjoyment of your property in terms of activities you might want to take on that are social, might interfere with your sleep. That's different, okay? So I think even the tort of trespass rests on interests. And I think the general lesson here is there's a mistake in Ripstein's kind of Kantian theory. And the mistake is this. One piece of rightful relations among persons consists of establishing formal independence. Formal independence is a way of saying everybody's equal, everybody's independent, nobody's in charge of anybody else. If that weren't true, you'd kind of be a child, to the extent that that isn't true. Somebody's in an inferior status, they're not an equal citizen. But it also requires that they have the right interests protected against interference from other people. What the law of tort fundamentally does is to protect people against certain kinds of interferences and impairments. And it's very selective about that. It's perfectly okay to crush somebody's hopes by beating them in a sport. It's perfectly okay to drive somebody bankrupt in a fair market competition. All those things set back people's interests, but they're not tortious. And what the law of torts does is say certain kinds of interests are urgent enough, and it's possible, feasibly, to protect these interests against interference, and therefore we should, all right? And just one more example with negligence of how, if you don't think about interests, you can't really think about the subject at the heart of negligence. Ripstein gives an example saying, sort of that ordinary care is the care we usually exercise, but it couldn't just be anything. And one of his examples is, you know, it wouldn't become reasonably careful if everybody went around driving crazily for the thrills of it. And since I seem to be in a 50s American movie mode, I don't know if you know the James Dean film Rebel Without a Cause, with the scene about playing chicken, okay? So it's not that there's no, and chicken is a game where you and somebody else race your cars either at each other or towards a cliff. And the question is, who's going to bail out first? The person who does the chicken. If nobody bails out, you run head on into each other or you drive off the cliff, okay? Now, it's not the case that that serves no interest, all right? There's some interest in, you know, at least in the thrill of cheating death or improving some kind of macho interest in proving that you're gutsier than the other guy. If there were nothing at all there, you could not make it a central scene in a movie that had some popular resonance. But it's not an interest that justifies the imposition of any kind of significant risk on somebody else because it's stupid or however you want to characterize it, all right? but you can't explain why some risk impositions are impermissible without appealing to the urgency of the interest at stake. And that's not an interest we can regard as urgent. Conversely, the law of negligence in the United States says, if you're driving an emergency vehicle, so imagine a police or an ambulance, or even a person who has to get somebody else to the hospital because they require immediate medical attention, they've had a heart attack or something, you get to impose much more than the normal level of risk. Yes, you'd be careful as you can be, but you get to impose more than the normal level of risk. That's because we regard that interest as urgent, all right? So I think the account of the law of torts fails because it doesn't give a place for interest. And without a place for interest, you can't make sense of any of these torts. And I have other examples. I have examples having to go with privacy. Ripstein talks about impairing your means, but privacy, which I'm beginning to think we are all giving up, and it will never come back. That's from technology. But it's there in tort law, okay? And what privacy is not a means. It's a social condition. It's a social condition in which you're immune from certain kinds of unwelcome observation, okay? And to distinguish a privacy tort from like a trespass, there's a leading American example that involved a broadcaster for one of the sports network, and she's very attractive. And somebody decided they're going to be a peeping Tom and put a camera through her hotel room keyhole and observe her as she was getting undressed, and they posted it somewhere. This sort of stuff is a depressingly common feature of the virtual world. Well, that's not a trespass. It doesn't invade anybody's, the owner of the properties. Touching the keyhole invades the hotel's interest in ownership and control of it, the room. But it's not a trespass against the woman who was videotaped without her knowledge. It's an invasion of her interest in privacy. And you can't draw those kinds of distinctions without in each case characterizing the interest at the heart of the tort and why it's invaded in a certain kind of case and not others. You can't capture it by Ripstein's idea of just using someone without their consent, because you know, you imagine the contrasting case of she's hot. She's walking along the sideline at an American football game. Lots of people are going to think, oh, she's very attractive. And in a certain loose psychic guy sense, they're using her body for their own pleasure. But it's no fantasizing. There's no invasion of her interest in privacy in that example, because she has no expectation of privacy when she walks along the side of a football field broadcasting as a sports announcer. Whereas in her hotel room, she does. So to draw these distinctions, you have to invoke all these notions of interest. Okay, so I think I've gone 35 minutes, which means I'll do the rest of three. There are three basic other kinds of criticisms I have. One is that our law of torts, which I mentioned earlier, is split between forms of individual responsibility, private law of torts with fault liability and negligence at the center, and forms of collective responsibility. I also think that Ripstein's inability to draw interest, you can't account for negligence to strict liability inside tort law, but I'll just flag that. So we have forms of collective responsibility like workers' compensation, but we also have nuclear accident schemes and what they do in New Zealand, but you also have an inside tort and doctrines like vicarious liability of firms. And Ripstein's account is relentlessly individualistic, so he has to assimilate all those forms of collective responsibility to accounts of individual responsibility by taking notions of artificial persons. That misses the heart of what they're about. And the heart of what they're about is saying, you know what, in the modern world, risk is a feature of activities, and collective responsibility is the correct way to respond to it. We ought to respond collectively to the risks of the workplace. We ought to respond, in New Zealand, they think, we ought to respond collectively to the inherent risks of social life, because they're a product of our collective activity, and we as a community ought to accept community responsibility for them. Ripstein treats these things as if they were not competitors to responsibility and tort, but radically different box called public law or just matters of insurance. But they're not. They're a competing conception of responsibility, I think. The next one is, Ripstein makes a lot, as almost anyone with serious philosophical interest in the Anglo-American world will do, of where does he fit with respect to John Rawls's theory of justice. And he argues that, in a sense, that John Rawls's theory of justice, he's the right complement to it, a private law of torts. I think that's a mistake. I argue for various reasons in the paper that tort is not what Ripstein calls foreground justice, which is the justice of voluntary interactions. It's a part of Rawls's background justice, which is what he thinks his principles of justice govern. Background justice is interactions which we really can't easily avoid. And I think the core activities to which the law of torts applies are ones we really can't easily avoid. I mean, you can go be a hermit and live in the woods of Montana or something, but short of going to be a hermit and living in the wilderness, you can't avoid taking transportation, trains, cars, planes, boats, whatever. You can't avoid using power, being exposed to the risks of power transmission. Most of the activities that tort law applies to are ones that people can only avoid on pain of not leading a normal life. That's the sort of thing that belongs inside Rawls's principles of justice. The way to understand the relation of tort law to the principles of justice is to say those principles aren't principles of responsibility for conduct. Tort, like criminal law, is about principles of responsibility for conduct. But it starts out with the rights that people have, and the most important right in the law of torts is the right to the physical integrity of your person. The other is piece of this criticism is that tort actually can't be insulated from background concerns. The corrective justice theorists say the only thing that matters in a tort lawsuit is what transpired between the parties. And I think that's generally true. That's the core of it. But it can't be 100% insulated that way from a point of view of moral theory. And to give you an example, there's a current debate in the United States about how do we go about calculating damages. We use tables to calculate damages, and insurance companies use them even more. This stuff is not very far from stuff that's now surfacing about algorithms and whether algorithms have gendered and racist outputs, even when nobody thinks they put anything impermissible into them. But damage award tables in the United States compensate men more highly than women for the same injuries. And that's because they're constructed by looking back at earnings tables for men and for women. And the history of sexism and gender discrimination in the United States, which persists to this day, but one hopes it's diminished, is such that women earned a lot less at the same occupation than men earned. So what happens when you just take damage tables and use them is that you reproduce a form of gender discrimination. Without taking a stance on what you should do about that, I don't think the law of torts, what's the correct adjustment? Tricky question. But without trying to solve that question, it seems to me clear you can't just punt it. You can't just say tort is foreground justice, therefore we don't have to ponder whether or not our procedures for calculating damage awards reproduce historic social systematic injustice that didn't take place between the persons. I think I should stop there. So,
thank you, Mark.